Welcome to the Anderson Business Advisors Podcast, the nationally recognized preferred provider for asset protection and tax planning in the nation. This show is for investors and business owners looking to save on taxes and build long-term wealth with Toby Mathis, an attorney, author, business owner, and a featured instructor at Anderson's Tax and Asset Protection event held throughout the country. Enjoy the show.
Hey guys, you're listening to Tax Tuesday. This is Toby Mathis.
And Jeff Webb.
And welcome. Happy Tax Tuesday.
Thank you. Happy.
Couldn't have said it better myself. All right.
My brain's tired.
Hey, this is tax season. This is what's weird is we're in the middle of summer. It's like a 600 degrees outside here in Vegas, but it's a dry heat, so all it does is cook you.
You don't even know you're roasting.
Yeah, I'm like, fire is a dry heat. Still painful, right? No, it's we're in the middle of summer, and it's but we have a tax deadline next week. It's like evil. It's I don't know. Just feels really messed up.
So. Yeah.
All right, so let's jump in. We got a whole bunch of stuff to go over. It's gonna be fun. So, unlike other Tax Tuesdays, this one's gonna be a bevy of knowledge. So if you're here, we're going to have a good one today. All right. So be sure to follow us on social media. The place that I'd really advise you to go is YouTube, just because we put up a lot of content. The other thing to make sure that you know are all the fun rules we have here. We have two accountants on, two CPAs and a bookkeeper and two other folks, Patty and Susie, that will help point you in the right direction. So if you have lots of questions, we have professionals on right now. I don't know any place where you could do this, and especially not at the low, low cost of free. So if you have any questions that pop up, by all means, go into the question and answer field. And yes, we actually answer them off of those. When you're corresponding with us, sometimes we'll have a conversation with you. You'll be writing and we'll be talking, but we'll have a conversation. We'll ask for some clarification. Also, that little Tax Tuesday, this guy right here, you can see it right there. You can send in emails and ask us questions that way, too. That's where we pick our opening questions every time. And our opening cut questions today, what is the most tax-efficient way for a 401k to Roth 401k conversion? How do I start a real estate business with income from our current businesses? Is it possible? How do I elect trader status? If you are an active investor investing for passive income, are FICA taxes ever required to be paid on income? How can I identify tax breaks at certain income levels? I 1031 exchange a rental house from California to Nevada, quadplex. How can I get LLC protection without any 1031 exchange consequences? It's a good question. What is the easiest or best accounting software to keep up with your business expense in order to get the best tax deduction? And then we got these are some deep ones here. My mom and her siblings quit claimed my grandfather's house to me. Once I get a loan, I will pay them out of the proceeds tax-free at a price that was agreed upon. Being that technically I didn't buy it from them with the purchase and sale agreement, how would depreciation work on this house? Next one, and we'll answer that. And that has some of these have a bunch of nuanced issues that are going to be fun to go over. So I just kind of grab these at random. They give me a big old spreadsheet with hundreds of questions, and I grab ones that look like they're not 6 pages long, even though these ones look long, but you can see some of the stuff we get when we do that. I understand that the CARES Act allows me to borrow up to $100,000 or 100% of my vested interest in my 401k account through 180 days from the CARES Act enactment date of March 27, 2020, and that I won't owe any penalties or interest if I pay back the loan within 5 years. Also, the loan reimbursement period can be longer than 5 years if the funds are used to buy a home that is used as my primary residence. Is that information correct? Is it possible to borrow more than $100,000 from an IRA by combining it with the $50,000 401k maximum loan limit that existed prior to the CARES Act? Take out two loans, one for $100,000 and one for $50,000. We'll answer that. I have a limited partnership. My corporation is 1%. The partners have different shares. They all want us to do a 1031 exchange into their own purchases. Is this allowed? Interesting question. I'm a new home builder with 15 homes built a year. Do I expense home by home after it's sold, or can I do fiscal year expense and income accounting altogether? Good question. We'll go over that. I need to make a real estate business in California. I formed a Wyoming LLC. Do I need to file another California LLC, or is it okay to register the Wyoming LLC in California? What's the difference? So we're going to go through all of those. Let's first off, we have a little giveaway. We have coming up, and I believe it's in basically a week and a half. Oops, why does it say June? Oh, yo, yo. Here we go. July 18th. So this date, I have another Infinity Investing, or we have another Infinity Investing coming up. I have some really cool people coming on, including scheduled. I have Hans Johnson, Aaron Adams, Eric Dodds, and myself for this one, which is going to be fun. If you guys have never heard Hans, he's a really good speaker, and he'll be a lot of fun. That you can link and register for. It is absolutely free. And let me give myself some white ink at aba.link/IIW. Patty and them could probably send you out a link as well. Let's see. Yeah, there we go. And it's going to be a lot of fun. It's free. It's a full day, and we go over Infinity Investing strategies, which if you really want to know what it means, Jeff, how long have you been a CPA?
Going on 30 years.
30 years, and I've been doing this for 20-something years. We see a lot of tax returns, and we notice who makes money and who doesn't. And you know who usually doesn't make money? It's the ones telling you to do exactly what they're doing, and they're doing something crazy. And you see patterns, and you see who consistently makes money and who doesn't consistently make money. And so what we do is we figured that one out. And so we just teach what helps people make money. So it's a lot of fun. This is always good. So that is absolutely free. Invite your friends if you want. It's a live stream. And again, every one of them is a little different because the world's always changing. Plus, I have some really cool people. And again, if you haven't heard Hans and Aaron and Eric, they're a lot of fun. So anyway, let's go to some Q&A that's already come in because you guys are fast to the punch. And I know that there's been a whole bunch of people. What is this? There's a whole bunch of people that are already asking questions. I have several rentals, no registered entity, and claimed a loss on my 2019 taxes. Can I apply for an EIDL loan? So, Brandon, the issue, the answer is yes, an economic injury disaster loan. Pretend that the typical disaster that triggers this type of loan with the Small Business Administration, and this is a loan directly from the Small Business Administration. It's usually like a hurricane or a flood or a tornado just hit something and it just really messes up your business and you're getting a loan to basically cover you for the period of time that you're going to be, you know, kind of unable to operate or down. So usually they're based off of your expenses from the previous year and they give you about half of it, right? So it's a 30-year loan. It's at 3.75%. They're non-personal guaranteed. In other words, you're non-recourse against you, but they have a collateral requirement if they're over $25,000. What they did under the CARES Act is they gave a emergency grant that is free money based on how many employees you have. They basically treat you as having one employee if it's just you. So they'll give you $1,000. And then they'll give you a loan. The loans right now are capping out at $150,000. So you would take yourself and we would try to apply for you under an EIDL and you would be looking at your lost rents and we'd be looking at that. So hopefully, yeah, we'd be able to, the answer is yes, we'd be able to apply for it. So, and we would treat them all as one big activity. So it looks like Pi already got to the, what are the tax implications of investing in real estate through a self-directed IRA? And I'm not going to, well, I'll still go over it a little bit. Let's see if there's a few. See, these guys, it's so nice to have them on there, Jeff, because usually we're like panicking at this point that we've got 20 questions in the hopper. And
we just introduced ourselves.
Yeah. So they're just knocking them out. But the The idea of investing in real estate in an IRA is fantastic. The thing you have to be aware of is that if you have any debt in that IRA, you have unrelated debt financed income issues, which means if you make $10,000 and the, you know, and it was a property that was $100,000 and you had a $50,000 loan on it, that means half of that income is now attributable to the debt, and you pay tax on that. So after your expenses and things like that, you get to take that off and you get half the depreciation. In other words, basically you find out whatever that net is and you're going to have to recognize half of it as income. So that is not true of a 401k. And so there's a pretty big difference there. The good part about having anything inside of an IRA or a 401k is that you're deferring the tax on anything, on any of the income in there. With real estate, we can usually front load a lot of our deductions into those first couple years. So you lose the incentive to do that. But it's still not a horrible thing. Like if I have to choose, hey, either I leverage myself like crazy or I have $200,000 sitting in a retirement account and I buy two rentals, I'd buy the two rentals instead of trying to lever myself like crazy as an individual. So that's just me. And anyway, somebody says, of that loan that we just discussed, the economic injury disaster loan, is that forgivable? No, the EIDL is not. The PPP is. The emergency advance on the EIDL, you do not have to repay. That is free money, and it's limited to the number. It's $1,000 per employee. The lowest amount they'll give you is $1,000. The most they'll give you is $10,000. And then if you do have a PPP loan, then that whatever they give you on the emergency advance is taken off of your forgiveness under the PPP. That's how those two interact. But you can have both. Let's jump into the questions, just because I know what I'll do is I'll be answering the questions that people are asking online, and I'll forget that we have questions written down, right? What is the most tax-efficient way, basically, to convert a 401k to a Roth 401k?
As far as tax-efficient, you don't have to convert the entire amount in 1 year. I see people do that. I've seen people convert $1 million in 1 year and take a huge tax hit because of that. Mm-hmm. Whereas if they had taken it in smaller chunks, they could have kept their taxes much lower in those years. The problem with converting a 401k to a Roth 401k is you're either going to have to work with your plan administrator to do that, or if it's a self-directed 401k, you're going to have to work with a custodian to get that Roth 401k account set up and established.
Mm-hmm. Here's the thing. From a tax standpoint, the difference between these two is I get a tax deduction for putting money in a 401k and I pay tax when it comes out. On a Roth, I don't get a tax deduction for putting it in, but I don't pay tax when it comes out, whether it's a Roth 401k or a Roth IRA. The biggest difference is Roth IRAs phase out on income and Roth 401ks don't. I don't think you have a conversion limit. You could always convert something.
Oh, yeah.
But here's the thing. It almost never makes mathematical sense to convert at a higher tax bracket. In other words, if I convert and I pay tax now, and let's say I'm in the 37% tax bracket, it's next to impossible for me to make up that big tax loss, that 37% loss of every dollar by the time I retire, to make the math work out to where I'm better off. So when I do the calculators, and I actually have a calculator that I use to see whether or not it's better to do a IRA or a 401k versus a Roth, or even doing an IUL, a non-qualified plan. If you are in a higher tax bracket, take the deduction always, because chances are you're going to be in a lower tax bracket when you retire. And if that's you, a traditional IRA or 401k is better. When a Roth is better is when you're younger and you have more time to let it cook and simmer and grow, and you're in a lower tax bracket and you're either going to be in the same or greater tax bracket when you retire. If that's you, then you do the Roth. So if you're young, lower tax bracket, put it into a Roth 401k, put it into a Roth IRA. If you're in a higher tax bracket, do not convert. I see people do this all the time. It's like when they're in their 50s, and I'm like, you realize that? Mm-hmm. You're never going to make up that tax hit. it literally takes 25 to 30 years to absorb that tax hit. It's just not going to happen.
Now, I got one other time that it makes sense to do the conversion. I've had a crappy year. My business has done terrible. I got that big net operating loss, not a capital loss, but a net operating loss.
Right, but you're not in a high tax bracket at that
point. At that point, yeah. Go ahead and do that conversion.
Absolutely. I agree. All right, so here's the rule.
But that still goes along with what you were saying. Yeah. Don't do it when you're high.
Let's just say, I'm going to give you guys a bright line rule. If you're at 22% or higher, probably don't do it. If you're at 22% or lower, probably do it. It's worth getting a pencil out and doing the math to see. If you have a great, huge opportunity that you're once in a lifetime that you think is just going to explode, and you are sure it's going up and you're going to invest, and you could invest with retirement money, maybe you convert because you're going to make so much money in your Roth. I've seen that. The PayPal guy did that. I think he made like millions and millions of dollars in his Roth.
So say you're a senator and you've got inside information on a stock.
You're not allowed to trade insider stock anymore. They were actually able to do that for years. That only stopped like 10 years ago. Ridiculous. All right. Q&A. We got lots of questions. You guys are typing a lot today. There's Sherry. Hey, Sherry, I owe you a phone call, so I'm going to call you after this. Can negative depreciation from a business offset W-2 income? So Leo. So depreciation, you wouldn't call it negative depreciation. What you would call it is depreciation that creates a loss, or, you know, depreciation when you have a loss. And can it offset W-2 income? It depends.
Yeah.
And it depends on whether it's an active trader business or whether you're passive. If you are passive, then no, which means I don't materially participate in the business, or it's real estate. There's some exceptions, real estate professional status, active participant in real estate. But in a business, typical business, then, yeah, you usually it's going to offset your other income. You have some rules. So if it's like an S corp, it's your loss is limited to your basis, whatever you put in there. Or if it's a C corp, you can't take it. Unless you dissolve the C corp, in which case you could write off up to $50,000, $100,000 if it's a married couple. Partnerships flow right on through.
Yeah.
Sole proprietorship flow right on through. Of course, sole proprietors have their own issues, but generally yes. And then with a net, if it creates a net operating loss, then Jeff's going to tell you how far can you carry that back?
Not at all. Well, I'm sorry. With CARES, you can carry it back 5 years.
Yeah, we just changed that.
I know.
I was giving you a soft. I know. I was like loading you up.
Yeah, 18, 19, and 20, you can carry it back 5 years. And then in 2021, I believe, it goes back to the old rules that no longer carry it back.
All right. I made $800,000 trading options in an LLC so far for 2020. Is it possible to be taxed as a corporation? Brian, you're not going to want to be taxed as a corporation if you made option money, because option money is considered capital gains. If it's realized option money, it'd probably be short term if you made it this year, and it's not subject to self-employment tax. That said, you still want to have a corporation in the mix, and usually it's going to be a partner in a partnership, the LLC being taxed as a partnership. So we'd have to look at that LLC and see how is it taxed, and do we have a corporation to help split income as the management entity? That's a nice chunk of change, but you're going to find the hard news is it's going to be ordinary income more than likely, unless you could find some expenses. Now, there are ways to shave that down. In the big ones, this is actually kind of goes to another question someone's asked, I remember later, which is about deductions at certain levels. When I have people that are in the $1 million and above, my go-tos are I'm looking for a spouse to qualify as a real estate professional, or them to qualify as a real estate professional and look at buying more real estate. I'm looking at conservation easements, legitimate conservation easements that are not listed transactions, which means none of this craziness out there. You're looking for five times being the maximum, 250%. Deductibility. I look at public charities that you may set up and operate, be on the boards of, where we're able to take a lot of we're able to make some deductions that way. I look at income splitting with corporations. I look at defined benefit plans, like a little bit more amped up retirement plan, not just a 401k, although we do both at the same time. You I don't do defined benefit plans, but if you use a defined benefit plan, you're almost always doing it in conjunction with a 401k. But those are your big ones. And any that I'm missing, kids, maybe paying your kids.
Not that you're telling them to have more kids.
Yeah, have lots of kids, get that. Pay other taxpayers that are doing things for your business to the extent you're able to. And then during the year, you want to incur expenses that you'd be incurring later on. So you want to make sure, like, if you were to incur them in the year, next year anyway, you may want to incur them before the end of the year. So just giving you a whole bunch of bevy of options. Next question. How do I start a real estate business with income from our current businesses? Is this possible?
Typically, you're going to have to pull money out of those businesses and establish a new entity for the real estate. I'm assuming these are trades or businesses where they're actually doing some type of trade. So I don't know that I want to put real estate in that mix.
So you always have this weird thing where people, you have I want to start a real estate business. And do I blend it with my current business? Is there a way to do it? And the answer is going to be a big fat, it depends. And the reason it depends is, how is your business taxed? What does your business do? And is there a way to treat it as one activity from a tax standpoint while separating out the liability of the two? And so let's say that in my case, let's say that I'm doing tax work and we have a firm and we decide to buy a building. We could still buy that building, same owners as the firm, and we could rent it to the firm, and the IRS lets us treat that as one activity. And that's one of the few cases where you can take real estate losses and offset the income from your active business. But I have a feeling that what these guys are asking is, how do I get money out of my business so I can start a real estate business? And then the issue there, again, is what type of business is it? Is an SRC Corp? And or partnership or sole proprietorship. If it's S partnership, S corp partnership, or sole proprietor, you just take the money out. It's going to be taxed to you no matter what. C corp, you may want to make it your lender, and you might want to set up a separate business that's doing the real estate. Buying passive real estate's the best, in my opinion. And it's absolutely possible to do it. It's possible to do it. In some cases get huge tax benefits. In other cases, you're just saying, hey, I want to keep it separate from me. So you could actually do it. Somebody said from our previous question, for stock option trading, which tax status is better, C corp or S corp? What's the rationale for the same? For stocks and options trading, Adam, you're looking at capital gains. And actually, we have a question in here. Actually, it's the next question. It's the trader status one that's going to pop up here. So that'll be relevant. But what I usually do is I look and I say, first, do no harm. I want my capital gains to flow under my return if I want them to. So you're either going to have capital gains that are short term or long term, and they'll be taxed at either your ordinary rate or at long term capital gains rates, depending on how long you held the securities and how long you held the option.
And while capital losses for the individual are limited to $3,000 a year, for a corporation, they're limited to zero. You actually have to have other capital gains to offset them.
Yep. Which means, Adam, we want your stock account. Generally speaking, it's going to be in a limited partnership or an LLC taxed as a partnership. And a partner in that is going to be a corporation. And we're going to give it guaranteed payments to operate and run that LLC. Because you don't get to write anything off against it. You don't even get miscellaneous itemized deductions anymore. They completely nix those under the Tax Cut and Jobs Act. So here you are working your katush off. Let's say that you're working real hard and you're running a great structure and you're profiting. Heck, we just had someone say they made $800,000. And you don't get to, and they're going to treat that as almost like a hobby. It's not quite as bad. In fact, no, actually, it's worse because you can't write anything off. They're going to treat you worse than a hobby.
Right.
You don't get to write nothing off. You might get an investment interest expensive.
And what makes a corporation important is if you're having substantial fees or expenses from your investing. I know some of the brokerage firms, if they're managing your account, charge a substantial fee for that. And you cannot write that off on your 1040. However, the corporation can, since they're managing your investments in your limited partnership. We've kind of found that this is the best way to work it if you're want to invest in an entity you can move some of that income over to the corporation where you're going to have additional expenses anyway.
And I'm probably using a C corp in that circumstance because I want to be able to split some income in case I have a little extra money that I'm paying over there. Keep it out of my tax bracket, knowing that if I want to get the money out of the corp, all I have to do is wait enough time, incur enough expenses that it's reimbursing me on. So things, and I like to have a family business. I don't know about you guys, but I'm never going to set up a corporation and say, this is all it's doing. No, it's going to do lots of fun stuff. It's going to manage my accounts. It's going to look for investment opportunities. It's going to make sure that we are educated on all the new strategies from everything from real estate to stocks to small business to management to legacy planning, you name it, to anything that will help you as a family and your business grow, you run it through there. And if your kids need better equipment to help that business, then it's they're working for that business. You don't have to pay them a salary, although it makes sense quite often to pay kids a salary because you pay them $10,000 a year, it's tax-free. It's going to be pretty much free money to them. So anyways, long question or long answer. Can a REIT be formed from an IRA based on real estate? Technically, no. A REIT is a real estate investment trust, and it's set up to own real estate. It's subject to specific rules. You may be thinking, can I just own a real estate entity like an LLC inside of an IRA? And the answer is yes. But if you're doing a traditional publicly traded REIT or a real estate investment trust that has profit requirements, you wouldn't use an IRA. An IRA could own a piece of a REIT.
Yeah, I was going to say that.
But the IRA wouldn't be the actual entity. So I like REITs. Me personally, I wouldn't form one. So if somebody's asking me how I would form it, I would talk to a good securities lawyer if that's the route you're going, but it's going to be very, very expensive. We're talking probably close to seven figures to get one off the ground. That's just my best guess. They're very expensive. And you have to distribute, I think it's 90% of the profits every year anyway. So for me, I'm probably not going to do it. But I don't mind buying them. And a really good one is Federal Realty Trust. It's been paying out increasing dividends on an annual basis for more than 50 years. And it's taken a little bit of a bloody nose with the real estate fears. And that's a good one. It's a dividend king, and I like it, FRT. And I think it's around $88 or something like that right now.
So. Yeah, it kind of tells you how complicated REITs are in that their 1099s don't have to be issued until like May 15th.
Oh, they're a dumpster fire from an accounting standpoint.
Which is why you often see corrected 1099s from your broker.
Somebody says, thoughts on going the Roth 401k route as insurance against future higher rates. Everybody's been saying that for decades. The government's going to raise rates. You know who they raise rates on?
The wealthy.
The wealthy. They're going to hit the wealthy eventually. And that Roth 401k, it depends on what your tax bracket is now. The Roth is going to be zero. So I get it. It's a great hedge. But if you're in a high tax bracket, I'm not willing to bet that my tax bracket's going to be higher than what I am in the prime of my earning. It's just not going to happen. Almost everybody, their income goes down in retirement. And the average tax bracket, I looked this up, gosh, about 2 months ago. So it was like in some states, it was single digit average. So and then you look at the median and it's probably closer to around 15%, which means the 50th percentile. So if you're average, your chances are you're going to be in a much lower tax bracket than you are right now. So let me jump onto this next one because I know you've been salivating to talk about trader status. You can go out for this one. How do I elect trader status?
You elect trader status simply by saying you're a trader. However, there is a second election that's far more important.
Wait, you can just say I'm a trader.
Now you say I'm a trader.
I know. Isn't that crazy?
And it really doesn't change anything.
Someone just wrote it on their return. You're just like saying, hey, I'm a trader.
What most people are actually talking about is the mark-to-market election, which allows you to recognize capital losses as ordinary losses with no limitation. However, there is a, what's the word you used, a bevy of cases throwing trader status out.
Tons.
It is so easy to screw this up.
Yeah, it's regular, frequent, continuous. If you have a W-2 job, chances are you're not going to qualify.
Yep, saw that one.
If you don't trade at least they're saying you're safe at about 1,000 trades right now. Some people would say 700 trades a year. Like, you have to be really active, and you better make sure they're short term. If they sniff appreciation or long term play, you're not a trader.
And by long term, we don't mean a year. We mean days, weeks.
Yeah. Well, they actually say daily swings.
Right.
So technically what they do is they look and they say, what's the average holding period? Or they'll divide them up saying, you held these ones for this long and then you held these ones. If you go over 30 days.
We had the one case where they threw them home. They weren't a trader because their average holding period was around 30 days.
Yeah, that's right. 32 days. Yep. And they said, nope. So the cases, it's like a minefield out there of why you're not a trader, which should just tell you, I don't really want to do it because I don't want to have to go explain it to a judge. Number two, when you make that mark-to-market election, I'm prejudiced as all get out on this one. Because in 99, the market was going crazy, and then it just turned and face-planted in 2000. That was the tech bubble bursting. So the way that mark-to-market election works is they treat your accounts as being liquidated on December 31st. So if you have positions, it's like you sold them all.
Right.
So we had Qualcomm. I still remember this like yesterday. It went up like it was hundreds of dollars in those last couple months. And it just skyrocketed. And then it face planted the following in 3 months into 2000. And it was people couldn't sell it and pay their tax bill. And I said, why would you do that to yourself? You're creating fake rules and you're just punishing yourself. So I was just like, yeah, I don't think I'd ever do that. So I don't like people filing for trader status. I don't like mark-to-market election.
I don't either.
The reason people do mark-to-market election is so that the loss goes on to form, what, 4797, and it becomes ordinary loss.
Right.
As opposed to capital loss, meaning, hey, if I lose my katush gambling in the stock market, then I can write it off. And I liken it to saying I'm a professional gambler. Be prepared to be scrutinized, and you better show that that's how you make your living. If that's not you, and I would hope that this is not you, most people don't make money consistently as traders. Most people I see, about 80% lose money doing active trading, like where they're trying to play the daily swings of the market.
Yeah, you're really betting against the computers. Some people do well, but most do not. So let's say that you do decide to make the mark-to-market election. That election has to be made by the original due date of your tax return, meaning it's due in 8 days.
Mm-hmm. You have to make that election by without extensions, the due date of the tax return, for this year, not for last year, for this year. This is the weirdest rule. They use last year's tax return as the due date for an election that would be this year. But I don't even want to tell people this because I don't want them to do it. The only people who do mark-to-market elections are the ones that lose money.
And worse, we've had clients who have taken advantage of those capital losses, then had a really good year, and it hurt them bad because they had to pay ordinary rate tax rates on it, not the capital gains rates.
Yep. And the easier route is just to structure it as a partnership LLC or an LP with the corporation as the manager, as the guaranteed payment to partner, the person, the company that gets paid no matter what. And that gives you a lot of opportunities to get some deductions. And that's the reason people make the trader status election anyway. They do it because they say, I'm a business, even though the IRS doesn't let you write off expenses unless you really have to be in this stuff to get a write-off. Hey, a few questions, and you guys have a lot of them. I know that Elliot and Pio and Tavia are kicking around and zipping through these, but hey, this would be fun. My wife and I are S-Corp with another partner. Can we open and fund a solo 401k for my wife before July 15th? Not for 2019. The rule changes this year so that you would be able to do this next year under that scenario.
Right.
You can actually start your 401ks later. If you're partners in an S-Corp, you guys can do a solo 401k with a partner. I think you could have up to three potentially if you're all partners. So I think a husband and wife and a partner would work. If you couldn't, you would just open up a traditional 401k, but the solos are a little bit easier to operate as long as you don't have employees. And if you have employees, as long as they're under 30 hours a week, and I think you can put a 3-year vesting on it or something like that. So Would you be able to do it for and contribute for 2019? No. Would you be able to do it for 2020? Yes. And you can go all the way up until the end of the year and enact a 401k. And the big benefit to a 401k is you can defer income into it, and the employer can make a contribution up to 25% of that income.
One of the keys to the 401k is you have to have salaries. You have to have compensation as defined by your plan, but it's usually salary or some kind of wages.
What does it say? Does the IRS allow one-time non-taxable gift to a spouse? Yeah, you actually have the gift exclusion. For a spouse, right?
Yeah, it's not a one-time exclusion. It's
Somebody wrote Pyle. No, this is a one-time non-taxable gift to a spouse. You have an unlimited spousal exclusion.
Right.
So we're going to make fun of Pyle. He's looking at it, and he's giving you the rules for Pyle. We're going to make fun of you. You have to go back in and fix that. Actually, I don't think you can. So we get to make fun of Pyle. No, you can. Your one-time gifts and things like that are to individuals other than your spouse, and it's $15,000 a year, and you have, I think your lifetime limitation is the same as the federal, or is it 5 million?
No, the lifetime limit is the same as federal. It's the 11 point whatever it is.
So it's actually 11 point close to 4 million now, I think. It might be up there. I should actually look. I probably have a tax cheat sheet and classes somewhere. I'm going to tell you exactly what it is. GST, gift tax exclusion, it was 11.4 in 2019. So 2020, it's going to go up, probably closer to 11.5. So you can give me $11.5 million, and you don't have to pay any tax on it. So you should remember that around Christmas time, Jeff.
All my kids are getting millions.
All right. Well, somebody had a really funky question, but it says they left, so I was going to answer. Now we're not. Let's go to... If you are an active investor investing for passive income, so rental income, is FICA taxes ever required to be paid on income?
Rental income is almost never subject to, it would be self-employment tax, which is the self-employed version of FICA and Medicare.
And it's not. The only way you're ever going to get hit in real estate with FICA, which, you know, realistically what Jeff has just said is true, it's actually old age death, survivors, benefits, and Medicare. The only way you're going to get hit with that is if you're a dealer, you're flipping properties, you're a developer, you're developing property, you're a builder, I'm building properties, in which case then your income is active income. But if you're passive, even if you're an active investor, it's still passive. It's not subject to self-employment tax. So rents, royalties, dividends, interest, and capital gains are never subject to self-employment tax. You have to make it into ordinary income by doing something. And the way you do something in real estate is you become a dealer. So you buy things to sell them. If you're buying things for appreciation and for cash flow, you're fine. So,
and just being a real estate professional doesn't change that either. That is not the same as being a dealer of real estate.
Mm-hmm. That is true. Somebody says, how do I become a real estate professional? A real estate professional is a tax status, and really all it is it's a section of the Internal Revenue Code 469C7, where it just says, here's an exception to real estate being treated as passive, the losses. So if you have passive losses, you can't subtract them against active income, except in very few circumstances. One of those is active participation in real estate, where you make less than $100,000 a year. It phases out between $100,000 and $150,000, but you can write off up to $25,000. So if you're a taxpayer and you're making less than $100,000 and you hire your manager for your properties, then it would be you're not going to have to pay, or you're going to get to write off the loss against your active income. So if you lose $10,000 and you make W-2 income of $100,000, you would reduce your taxable income now down to $90,000. Real estate professional just makes that unlimited. And now it doesn't matter how much I make. So if you want to pay zero taxes, we have doctors that do this. The spouse will qualify for the surgeon, and they'll be able to go out and buy big chunks of real estate and lever it on up and take a big write off and save themselves hundreds of thousands of dollars in taxes. And it makes the real estate that much cheaper. If you currently have zero income and take your retirement, does it make sense to convert the traditional IRA to Roth IRA? If you have zero income, aren't you in a lower tax bracket? No, Felicia, you're actually in the same tax bracket. So zero versus zero. So if you're in the zero bracket, does it make sense to convert it?
No, because
it's
actually
push you up. It'll push
yeah,
you
it's going to push you into a higher bracket.
You're better just to keep taking the money out unless you have a big windfall coming up. Somebody said about trades. It's you need to be trading 4 to 6 hours a day. Oh, on trader status. I see what you're doing, Sherry. The cases don't require it. There's people that have actually gotten trader status where it was the number of trades becomes the most critical thing. Where they nail you is when they show that you have a full-time job and that you couldn't be trading. And they like to say that this is your full-time occupation and they average you out over a year. It's kind of goofy.
Yeah. And I've seen it where they did substantial, regular and frequent for a period of time,
yeah,
but not for the whole year. And they got busted for it.
Yep. Somebody said, would my question be answered? Yeah, they're getting to you. Do not worry. We're answering all the questions that pop up, and I'm grabbing a bunch of them and reading them out when I see a gap. So I'll look back at yours. Here's the one that was written in. How can I identify tax breaks at certain income levels? And that's like one of those open-ended questions mm-hmm. that we all love, right? Here's kind of a general thumbnail sketch, and this is what I use unless you want to throw in what you know, everybody's a little different. But if you are, generally speaking, below the $100,000 threshold, you're able to do IRAs, you're able to do HSAs, you have various types of tax credits that you're not phased out on. You have the standard deduction, which is going to be, what is it, $24,000 this year? I need my 2020, but there's a big standard deduction. So you're not going to pay much in tax anyway. Where I look at people and I get annoyed is when you have somebody who's making $40,000 a year and they have capital gains at the end of the year and they don't sell it because they're afraid of the tax hit on it. And then you explain to them, there is no tax hit on it. It's zero if you've held it over a year. Long-term capital gains, if you're married filing jointly and you're less than $80,000, is zero. Sell it and buy it right back. You'll never have to pay tax. You just reset your basis. So, you know, so you look at those things in the lower, I don't want to say lower, 100,000 is still a lot of money, but under 100,000, we're looking at those things. You're able to do standard, you know, retirement plans. So you're using your 401ks. I personally think it makes sense to start looking at your, you know, things like your Roths underneath that amount. It makes sense to look at indexed universal life underneath those amounts as far as supplementing your retirement plan, those types of things. And when you get over that level, now we're looking at other types of retirement plans. That's mm-hmm. when I switched from IRA and 401k to just 401ks. And when I hit around 200,000, I'm looking at defined benefit plans too. Right. If you've been there for a while, defined benefit plan is a retirement plan on steroids. We have people putting hundreds of thousands of dollars a year in those tax deferred, just like a regular, you know, just like your IRA, except one case, literally $600,000 a year, a little over. When you get over the $1 million mark, now we're using everything in our toolbox from oil and gas to conservation easements to defined benefit plan plus a 401k plus splitting income with the corporation plus splitting income with kids or other adult relatives that work with you. We just have to justify it, and we're trying to get that money from hitting you. Because you're losing half of it for every dollar that hits you. That's when we're really looking at real estate, saying, is there any way we can get somebody qualified as a real estate professional? And then the end all be all is, if you're going to be making that type of money, you really do need to have some sort of charity attached to your plan. And in our world, it's a charity that we organize and that we run, and that allows us the ability to, with the stroke of a pen, reduce our tax bracket at the end of the year easily, consistently, and do some, you know, and you, before you think charity is just giving your money away, no, you can operate an operating charity in housing. You know, low to moderate income housing qualifies. There's all sorts of things that we have people do, and sometimes you see them on this show because we're pushing them. If you want to see some of the really cool charities that we work with that have been created from our clients, just go on to our podcast and invariably I'm putting probably one on a month, but you could see some really cool stuff that they do. Let's see what else we got. Did you have anything you wanted to throw on there?
No, I mean, we do run into sometimes these tax breaks are going to be circumstantial based on what business you're in. Like my brother has a produce business, and is it time to upgrade equipment to take tax breaks for that? But you're going to see a number of things like that are circumstantial depending on your circumstances. I guess it would make them circumstantial.
What you're saying is absolutely true. Sometimes you're looking at purchasing something and you're front-loading the purchase. Because use the example, really good example is us. Probably, I want to say 10 years ago, we purchased copy machines in one of the buildings. Mm-hmm. And I think we purchased five or six of them. And they were, you know, the book value on those was over $1 million. And we leased them. What we had that kind of that dollar lease. I forget the term of it now. I used to know it off the tip of my tongue. But when you have a paid on expiration of 10% or less, you could capitalize that. And all that meant is that you can write it off in the year that you acquire it, even though you didn't put the money down. And so it was the dangest thing. It was the end of the year, and they gave us $56,000 check to pay off our other machines. They took the machines out. We're storing them until the end of that lease term. We took in our machines and we were able to capitalize them, meaning we were able to take a deduction for the value of those machines. So we took about a $1.4 million deduction. And we didn't actually come out of pocket a penny. It was actually $56,000 was put back in our pocket. And that's what you end up doing. The higher income goes, you're starting to look at things like that where you're able to get some tax relief. And then you also start to switch your income type to things where there's a maximum. So, for example, long-term capital gains has a maximum of 20%. So I'm probably going to start looking at dividends and long-term capital gains a lot more closely because I don't have to worry about the dreaded 37% tax bracket, what used to be the 39.6. Depending on who gets elected, expect that to go back, expect estate taxes to come back, expect a whole bunch of stuff to come back, really regardless, because we just levered the heck out of ourselves with all these wonderful programs that we enacted to bail everybody out. I had started an LLC last year with the intention of getting started with my real estate business. However, there were some changes in my main job that kept me from proceeding. Am I correct in presuming that I still need to file a tax return, even though I have no deductions? Jeff, if you have no activity, you would just file a no activity. But if you have expenses, which you definitely do if you set up an LLC, you have its organizational expenses, startup expenses, the filing fees, and everything else, you would need to file that in the first year.
Now, we have had some people opt not to file that return, but that was knowing that they were going to lose those expenses.
Yeah. Why'd they do that?
They would rather not file that initial return because there was only $1,000 or so on
of deductions. So they said, hey, it's not worth it.
It's not worth it.
Yeah. But then they get to, they would capitalize that, right?
No, because what the code says about partnerships in general is if you have any income or expenses, you're supposed to file a return.
So you're supposed to file a return.
Yeah.
If you have any expenses, file a return. It will make it easy. Unless there's a compelling reason to not have any expenses, attribute them to another entity.
And IRS is not going to make you report expenses.
Yeah. They're just going to say, hey, rather than file a return. Hey, is it still possible to elect S status for 2019? Yes. You do a late election, and it's you end up writing across the top of the return
Prog, I think 2015-30.
Jeff would know this way better than I. So you actually write it. Is it on the 1120S?
No, you actually have to put it on the 2553.
2553 and save.
And then you include the 2553 with your return and you still send it into entity processing.
So the answer is yes, we can still treat it for last year. And that's going to trip some of you guys out. There's a revenue procedure that allows us to do it. And what's our success rate on that?
Pretty high. More often than not, there's something wrong with the form as a reason for rejecting it.
So somebody tried to do the 2553, it was rejected or what?
Yeah, they did the 2553. Maybe it was missing a signature or the effective date was incorrect or...
And so when you do the rev proc, is it almost automatic, right?
It's almost automatic. You do have to give a reason as to why you're filing late, but it's...
You blame it on the accountant.
Blame it on the accountant.
We're good at being blamed. Somebody says, awesome. We love it when that's a good. Somebody said something about their... 121 exclusion. You have to live in it two of the last 5 years as your primary residence, and then you don't have to pay tax on a portion of the capital gains on somebody's house. If you've lived in it, if you moved out 3 years ago, you're really not going to get any. You would you even get a partial? You wouldn't get anything, would you?
If you moved out of 3 years ago?
Yeah. So I lived in it for 2 years. Now I didn't live in it two of the last 5 years. I lived in it one of the last 5 years because I've rented it for 4 years. Now I wouldn't get any.
There is a partial exclusion if it's job. The move is job related. Some other circumstances that are extreme. That's
if you're forced to sell and you didn't meet the two at a
correct
test. But here we met our two, but then we waited too long. We made it into a. Here's the thing.
I'd go back and amend it.
Here,
my return.
You might.
I would definitely go back and amend.
Here's the thing. It's not bad to have investment properties, guys. You can 1031 exchange. And so what I would do is if you have it as a renter, you can actually do a 1031 exchange and 11 and a 121 on the same property. It twists people's heads because you lived in it for 2 years as your primary residence.
Uh-huh.
You rented it for 2 years. It is now a rental property that you lived in two of the last 5 years. So it's you can 1031 exchange it into another investment property, but you can exclude the one you actually take the exclusion, which is $250,000 for single people or $500,000 for married filing jointly. You take that exclusion.
So in the particular case you're talking about, they lived in it for at least the 2 years, but they've held it more than 3 years.
Exactly.
Before they sold. Yeah. There's nothing you can do there.
Yeah. I think you're toast, but you can still 1031 exchange. Somebody says, what if I sell a rental property that I've been holding for 20 years that is debt free? My annual income in 2019, $32,000 filed jointly. Did I hear you say I would not have to pay capital gains? So you don't get a portion of it. So capital gains still gets added into your tax bracket for determining where you land on the capital gains schedule. So you would get $50,000 of that if you sold it for $3 million. We'd have to figure out your basis and capital.
All right, yeah, your basis is going to be very low.
Yeah, so you would get $50,000 of it tax free. You'd get maybe you want to sell a small interest. I could see this being something where they sell it to maybe a family member or something and start piecing it off, but. No, when you have that type of deal, if I'm selling that, I'm 1031 exchanging it into something else. Now, what usually happens, Julie, is somebody will be at the $32,000 level and they'll have a bunch of stock that's gone up. And the accountant will say, oh, if you sell it, you're going to have to pay tax on it. And I'm looking at him going, wait a second. If you have no real income, like in your situation, you could literally sell and generate, what would that be, $48,000 and not have any capital gains at all. Like it's capital gains, but it's at zero until you hit the $80,000 mark.
Right.
So it's huge. It's huge, 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 huge. All right. Let's see. 1031. I 1031 exchanged a rental house from California to a Nevada quadplex. How can I get LLC protection without any 1031 exchange tax consequence? The way that 1031 exchange rules work is you have to go name to name. So if I own a piece of property in my name, I can sell it and I could buy any real estate of equal or greater value. And that just rolls my basis in the property I sold into the new property or properties. So, for example, I could sell here a rental house and I could have bought a quadplex or I could have bought a mobile home park. I could have bought a storage unit. I could have bought six condos. I could have bought three other rental houses. I could have bought one rental house. I could have bought one condo. Like you just fill in the blank. As long as it's equal or greater value, it just gets my new basis. But now I'm sitting out there just naked. And if I put it in an LLC, I will be fine. It does not destroy your 1031 exchange. The issue that you see sometimes is people will want to put it in an LLC with other owners and they'll play that game. And you got to be careful because you have to own that with the intent of holding it as an investment property. And if you play around with that and you do it too quickly, the IRS may investigate.
Yeah.
But for the most part, if you sell a property, buy another property, there's something called a swap and drop. There's a drop and swap and there's, you know, and then there's buy and transfer into another property. There's buy and transfer it into an LLC. But as long as you are the beneficiary of that LLC, like it's your LLC, you are still the same beneficial owner. Nobody cares. So they've already tried that. It used to be accountants would say 6 months, but all the facilitators I'm talking to, they do them right after, because nobody really cares now. It used to be they thought it was a disguised sale. So I'm going to 1031 exchange, and then I'm selling it out on an installment sale to Jeff over here. So I'm transferring to the LLC, and Jeff bought that membership interest, and now I just disguised a sale, which even that wouldn't, it doesn't really have much of an effect. They just want to.
So a little caveat, since you 1031 a California property, California doesn't like when you 1031 outside of their state. So what they've been doing for the past few years is there's a new form, and I can't recall the form number, that you have to continuously file with California until you get rid of the replacement property.
They want to know what their portion of that income is, because they're going to say that you have income that you earned in California you didn't pay tax on.
And if you exchange the Nevada property into another property, you still got to file the California form.
Yeah, California's just wanting to get paid at some point, so...
That's all it is.
Yeah, but it's a wonderful state with great beaches.
I didn't say anything.
Yeah. We all have the same thought. Nobody here likes the Board of Equalization, their tax authority, a bunch of vampires. And California is really hard on its people.
Yeah.
They have a great case, the Hyatt v. Commissioner case, where the agents followed a California resident into Nevada, broke into his house, was dumpster diving on him. They were just trying to nail that guy to the wall. They violated his civil rights. Guy sued. He won. It went to the Supreme Court because California was saying it was immunity, not sovereign immunity, but they were trying to declare immunity. And they ended up losing in the Supreme Court. They put it back down. And then they said, well, there's a cap of $50,000 on any case against us. And the Supreme Court, it went back to the Supreme Court, and they upheld it. So this poor guy had about 10 years of his life just turned on its ear. They followed him around. And at the end of the day, they had to pay, but it wasn't nearly as much. It was supposed to be millions of dollars for violating his civil rights. But that's California for you. The best thing to do there is just don't lock horns with them. I'm not going to tell you not to 1031 exchange, but it better be worth it. Let's just put it that way. Somebody's saying, hey, why don't you answer my question? There's hundreds of questions popping in. We will get to them. And I have, again, five people actually going through the questions. So we'll get through them. What do you do with income monthly interest if you do a seller carry back note? So let's say I sell Jeff my property. Ordinarily, if Jeff and I just, and I got paid 100% whatever I sell that property for, then I'm going to pay capital gains on whatever amount exceeds my basis minus the depreciation recapture, right? So I have a certain amount of gain. Let's say that I bought it for 100, sold it for 200, and I depreciated 20,000. So I sell it to Jeff. There's some expenses I'd be able to write off in the sale transaction. Let's just say I made 100,000 capital gains. 20 of that is depreciation recapture. So I would pay long-term capital gains, assuming I held it for over a year, on $80,000. I'd have $20,000 that's assessed to me as depreciation recapture, assuming that I depreciated it, or $20,000, whatever I said. And it would be taxed at my ordinary bracket with a maximum of 25%. And my basis is I get it back. So whatever I invested in that property, I get that back. So ordinarily, that would be the case. So let's say I'm in the 20% long-term capital gains bracket, I would pay long-term capital gains of $16,000 or thereabouts on that. If I was in the highest bracket, I'd also pay the net investment income tax, which, by the way, if the Affordable Care Act goes away, everybody who paid that should be applying.
You think so?
I think that's going to make a mess.
I find that hard to believe that would be overturned.
I think it's...
I mean, that part of it.
But that was part of the Affordable Care Act. Yeah. They throw it out as being unconstitutional. Anybody that paid a net investment income tax.
Well, yeah, because the whole goal of that net investment tax was...
They're saying you have to file a protective claim and stuff. Like, I think it's going to be really interesting. But anyway, that's an aside. There's $16,000 of tax. Now let's say that I sell that same house to Jeff. And instead of him giving me all the money, I agree to carry back a note. He gives me a portion of it down, and then he's going to pay me an income stream for the next 30 years. A portion of the money that I received would go to basis. A portion of it would be considered capital gains. A portion of it would be considered depreciation recapture, and a portion of it would be considered interest. And I would elect to do the installment sale on that. It's actually a form you file. And I don't have to pay tax until I actually receive the money. And then it's a formula. And I can't allocate most of it to basis, right? I have to spread it out over that 30 years.
When in your first year of sale, you're going to calculate what your profit percentage is.
Yep.
And each payment will be, after you take the interest portion out, will be multiplied by that profit percentage.
It gets funky.
So you'll have an amortization schedule just like you would get from your bank when you get a loan. And
you just do it on a spreadsheet, guys. It's actually really easy. You do it once, you just extend it out, you do the formula once, and then now you know of every dollar received. And then every year you're probably running that because somebody may miss a payment or pay an extra portion ahead of time. But always remember that there's four categories. There's basis, there's long-term capital gains, there's the depreciation recapture, and there's that interest. And so one of it's zero tax, one of it's zero, 15, or 20. One of it is maximum of 25, and the other one is your ordinary bracket. It's just like, so yeah, installment sales are cool, but what a pain. Somebody else had some cool questions. What is the definition of a real estate professional? You would ask that. We answer that probably about once every few episodes, right? It's 469C7, and all it is one spouse. Let's say you're married. One spouse has a real estate job of that where they spend 750 hours or more, per year. That's in construction, development, sales, reconstruction, redevelopment. Basically, you work in real estate.
But not financing.
Not financing, right. Some, yeah, the brokers have tried, but unless you're in the actual acquisition, no. So that's number one. And it has to be your number one use of your professional time. So if you're doing a job where you're spending 800 hours, you wouldn't be able to qualify you personally as the one that hit that 750 hours. So one spouse has to qualify. So usually what you see is spouse one's full-time job, spouse two is part-time at a max, and also a real estate professional. Sometimes they're in the real estate industry. You don't have to be licensed or anything like that. So that's step number one is I am that 750 hours. Number two is both spouses materially participate. And technically it's on each piece of real estate you own, but you could group them as one, what do you call it? When you grab all the rental properties.
Activity.
Yes. Yeah. So you're just grouping the activity. So you make a grouping election. Mm-hmm. And you're going to grab all your rental properties and treat them all as one activity. And there's nine ways to qualify for material participation. But the easiest is 500 hours between you and your spouse. Both of you added up together. So test number one is one spouse. Test number two is both spouses. And you just add all that fun stuff up.
And for the one spouse test, it has to be more than half of her time spent on all activities. Has to be in the real estate activities.
Yep, that's why I said if they're doing something else and they spend 800 hours, then you wouldn't be able to if you spent 750 hours in real estate. Now, if they spent 800 hours as a part-time teacher, so let's say, I'll give you guys a real scenario. Wife's a surgeon, husband's working as a teacher, husband spends 1,000 hours a year as a teacher, husband now needs to spend 1,001 hours on real estate to meet test hurdle number one. Hurdle number two, you're probably going to be okay.
Yeah, you've probably already met those test number two by meeting test one.
Yeah, you probably did. And then if you own a business, like if you're worried, hey, what if I have a business and I have partners? If you're greater than 5% shareholder of the business that's doing those activities, you count it towards you. So your time spent, like let's say that you're in a construction company and you're 25% owner, your time in that business counts towards your 750 hours and your material participation. No, your 750 hours. Your material participation is always on your property. So it has to be whatever you're doing. All right. What is the easiest or best accounting software to keep up with your business expense in order to get the best tax deductions? Jeff?
Well, I'm not saying it's either the easiest or the best, but by far the most prevalent is QuickBooks. You're more likely to find accountants who know how to use it than if you're using Peachtree or JD Edwards or SAP or any of these others. All of the softwares are going to accomplish pretty much the same thing. QuickBooks has a lot of good qualities about it. Now, the crux is Do you want to be spending your time doing your own bookkeeping? And are you actually good at doing your own bookkeeping? Because it's true what the old saying is, garbage in, garbage out. So you really need to know what you're doing. Just knowing how to use the software doesn't necessarily make you a bookkeeper or an accountant. You really need to have a gist of at least basic accounting.
Yeah. So I'm going to give you the, when I first started, and boy, did I suck at books statement. I cannot imagine somebody learning QuickBooks and starting up a business and running it. What I would do is hire somebody who knows QuickBooks, and then I would use spreadsheets. Mm-hmm. And I would just give them summaries, or I would just give them my bank statements, and then I would meet with them and say, what do you need to know? And usually with a chart of accounts, like a basic chart of accounts, how many, like if you're just looking at a profit and loss, you're talking what, 20 different categories maybe?
For expenses, yeah.
Yeah, so like it's not a huge amount, and you would just track those, and you'd go through your bank statements and make sure that you know, the bookkeeper usually just has to learn how you spend money and what is it on. And like you make it easy for them is you have a business account and you have a business credit card. And then whenever you do something personally, like you make sure that you note it in case you use that credit card and you say, oops, I just hit a personal expense. Or let's say that you did a business expense, you need to be reimbursed. Then you would just tell them, hey, you just put it on a little expense report. It's the easiest thing to do. Put it on a spreadsheet. Say, here's the expenses that I incurred. Keep a track of the receipt. I don't care. It could be on your phone. It could be a picture. It could be something you just type in there and you say, hey, I got the receipts in my box somewhere. As long as you have some backup somewhere, the accountants are going to be fine with you. And then let them do the QuickBooks. It's not worth it for you to be paying for QuickBooks. It's not cheap. Mm-hmm. And to try to learn how to use it. It's just not a good use of people's time. So that's me. Somebody says, is there any reason you folks don't have an automated P&L or just fill it in each year? Maybe I have a spreadsheet. Yeah, no, we do that, Andy. That's actually what I would suggest most people do. We have a virtual bookkeeping service, and that's exactly what it is you just send it in. We put it on a Google sheet, and you fill it in. And if you have a question, you just say, question, ask my account. You just put it in there and say, so we can go back and make sure that it's not done. And it's a little bit easier and it saves you a lot of time. I know you're probably like, trust me, I think that we learned probably on some of you guys that we don't want everybody having to do QuickBooks. It's just such a pain. And they keep making it so easy to use. Somebody's asking, I should go to this next slide. Somebody's asking, can you 1031 exchange a residence? Yeah, the same property. You can actually 1031 and 121 the same piece of property. You just have to make sure that for the 121 exclusion is your capital gains only. Capital mm-hmm. gains exclusion. It's not for depreciation recapture, but it's for personal property that you used as a primary residence. The 1031 exchange is for investment property. So if I want the capital gains exclusion, I just had to live in it two of the last 5 years as my personal residence, primary residence. It does not mean I lived in it the last 2 years. It's two of the last five. So technically, like let's say I had this happen in San Francisco. Somebody bought a house for $500,000. It was worth $2 million, and they were going to sell it. And they were looking at the tax bill on that as being over $300,000+. And they said, is there anything I can do about it? And I said, yeah. Move out of it, rent it to a friend or something for 6 months, and then 1031 exchange it. And we were able to avoid the tax in the entirety, roll that into other properties. And yeah, you can actually move back into that property. Said, don't do it for 6 months. Like, give yourself a period of time. But, would you do that for $300,000? Yeah, I'd probably do it for $300,000, where I'd say, I'll live in a different property for a while. Maybe I'll rent a house. And just do it and make sure that I'm crossing my T's and dotting my I's. Now, technically, there's no technical requirement that you rent your house. You just try to rent your house at a fair market. But I would say put a renter in there. There's no time frame, but I would say 6 months is so you never have issues. And then just make sure that you just rent a property for few months and just look at it as an extended vacation for $300,000. Mm-hmm. I'll take that action. You can make $1,000 a day in tax savings. I think I would do it. If somebody walked up to you and said, Jeff, I'll pay you $1,000 a day to rent a house, would you go do it?
I'd say, see ya.
Yeah. My mom and her siblings quick claimed my grandfather's house to me. Once I get a loan, I'll pay them out of the proceeds. Being that technically I didn't buy it from them with a purchase and sales agreement, how would depreciation work? So I just butchered that. I see what's going on.
Yeah, I'm not sure that I agree with the whole tax-free situation, because in my view, they are technically buying their...
This is a purchase. This is a purchase without a sale agreement.
Right.
And they agreed to a price.
That's a sale.
That's a sale. Right. Now, you're supposed to be in writing, but you have something here that where you agreed upon a price, and now you're paying them on it. Because if you didn't agree on a price, and now you're just gifting them money, they gifted you a house, you get their basis. You would depreciate your basis, their basis, on the gift.
At the very best, this would be two gifts.
Yeah.
A gift from the siblings to you, which they would need to file a gift tax return on.
My mom and her siblings quitclaimed my grandfather's house. So it sounds like grandfather's house went to mom and her siblings.
Mm-hmm.
So on
some I'm guessing she had an interest in it too.
It's my mom and her siblings. So that would be grandfather's kids.
Oh, gotcha. Gotcha.
So grandfather's kids got it. Their basis would be the value of the home on grandfather's passing. That's their basis. That's where they would depreciate this. They give it to you with the understanding that you're going to pay them X. That's a purchase.
Mm-hmm.
Your basis for depreciation is whatever that purchase and sale agreement is.
Right.
And then you get a loan and you pay them back. The thing is the gain would be determined by their sale to you. I'm hoping that this is fair market value. Like, hopefully it's pretty close to when your grandfather passed and that the house hasn't moved much.
And I was going to say that, that there may not be much gain at all if the grandfather recently passed.
Yeah.
Because your mother and her siblings' basis is going to be fair market value at the time of death.
Yeah, it's going to be really high. So this is great. And this could be you. I mean, this could be good for you. So somebody's asking funny questions. Can I 1031 exchange on a property that was rented 5 years ago and now is my primary residence? So the answer is no, unless you make it into a investment property. If it's personal property, you can't 1031 exchange. So I think it's the same thing where you'd have to get out of it and then...
So it currently has to be investment property to do the 1031.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't matter what it was years ago.
Doesn't matter. The only thing that we have to be careful of, Jennifer, is if the original property, if this property was a 1031 exchange, I think you're okay. I think you're okay because you had at least 5 years. So usually you can't 1031. So if you make a 1031 exchange property, your residence, your personal residence, you can't 121 for 5 years. So if you do what I just mentioned, you rent your property out, your personal house out to make it into an investment property and 1031 exchange it, your basis steps up, by the way, of that 121 mm-hmm. amount. So you get a higher basis if, when you do sell it, if you ever do, it's great. But you just can't do a 121 exclusion on it for 5 years. Not that you'd want to, but that's the only downside. I hope I made that make somewhat sense. I'm thinking it clearly, but it's probably coming out as garbly good. I understand that the CARES Act allows me to borrow up to $100,000 or 100% of my vested interest in my 401k account through 180 days from the Act. Yeah. And that I wouldn't owe any penalties or interest if I pay back the loan within 5 years. It's getting some weird stuff. Also, the loan repayment period can be longer than 5 years if the funds are used to buy a home that is used as my primary residence. Is that information correct? What say you,
Jeff? Okay, let's break this up a little bit. Now, you're correct that if you take a loan out and pay it back within 5 years from your 401k, you're not going to pay any penalty. Same with distributions. You're not going to pay a penalty at this time. Interest you will pay, but that will be interest you're paying back to your 401k plan that actually goes into your account.
Mm-hmm. So you don't have to worry about penalties, but you will have interest, and it's going to be about 4% that you're paying back to yourself.
Correct.
Under this portion of the CARES Act, what they might be thinking of is the 10% penalty of an early withdrawal, which they can get up to $100,000 for 3 years. And that one really is no tax, no interest, if paid back within 3 years.
Correct.
And that's an early withdrawal that you pay back. And they treat it as a rollover. but they're two different things. There's this, which you can take $100,000 out, and then there's this, the loan, borrowing, loan also of $100,000. And this one is actually 6 years. You have a year where you don't have to pay anything back. And then you have 5 years to pay it back. If it's a primary residence, it's the dangest thing. They don't have a term. It's up to your administrator. We say 15 years. Mm-hmm. So you can pay it back over 15 years, but it's still limited to that $100,000.
But I don't think they're going to let you take $100,000 out if you're using it to buy a home.
On the loan, you can use it for any purpose. On this, the early withdrawal, it has to be COVID related.
Okay.
So you or somebody you know has been drastic, you know, has been affected by COVID. You do a statement.
So even though you don't pay anything in that first year, I will let you know that interest is still accruing on that loan.
Correct. Yep. So it's kind of fun.
Let's go to part two.
Oh, part two, what's that? This?
No, there's another part. Next question.
Oh, you want to go to another question?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. So we're just going to shoot on over to this one. Is it possible to borrow more than $100,000 from an IRA by combining it with the $100,000 401k loan limit that exists prior to the CARES Act? These are two unrelated. I don't know how they got close to each other, but sometimes they do. So first off, can I just say this?
Are you going to say what I'm going to say?
No.
You are.
Loans from IRAs.
So you can't borrow from your IRA. You can't use it as collateral or security.
But you can take out a $100,000 early withdrawal under the CARES Act with no 10% penalty and no tax if repaid. How many years?
Three years.
Years. So pretend I wrote years instead of yours. Where are you from again? You're like,
I'm from Kentucky, but that's not what I say.
Yours.
We've been here for years. Down the holler.
Mm-hmm. All right.
And I am from Kentucky, so I'm allowed to talk like that. My family's from Tennessee, so.
My dad's from Mobile, Alabama. Parents met in Montgomery. My dad took acting lessons to lose his.
Wow.
Yeah, he was hardcore because we were in Philadelphia. He couldn't really have a draw there, so he took acting lessons. So I never heard my dad speak.
So the $100,000 limitation on the loans, that is for all loans from qualified retirement plans.
Mm-hmm.
If you already have a $50,000, let's say you took out $50,000 last year in a loan, you're only going to be able to take out an additional $50,000.
And it's up to your administrator.
Yeah.
They don't have to give you they don't have to move it to the $100,000. The maximum amount is $100,000 under the CARES Act, but it's up to your administrator as to whether they move it. But this early withdrawal you could take. So you would take an early withdrawal for $100,000. This needs to be paid back. And this is the way I read it, and I might be wrong, but you'd pay it back by December 31st of 2022. And then you'd pay zero interest or tax. You just pay it back. It is treated as a trustee-to-trustee transfer. Hey, somebody's from Mobile. My dad went to Murphy High School in Mobile, Alabama. And then you could take another $100,000 out if you wanted to. And this is a loan, and it's paid back over 6 years, 1 year defer, 5 years pay. So you can actually get $200,000. Fun stuff. Mm-hmm. We got some Mobile people. See, we got a bunch of, we got some Southerners. So I love Mobile, except for the paper mill, if I remember right. Always kind of smelly there. No, my folks met at Auburn University. So some people know that, not too many, because we didn't spend any time there. Here we go. Pensacola, Florida. Hey, that's where my grandparents lived. I know Pensacola very well. I got used to go on those beaches. I drove down there right after Opal flattened it. I think it was, was that 90s, early 90s? Anyway, so I'm just going to jump to this last one because I don't know if this is the last one because Jeff has gone over. And, that was beautiful country, by the way. Gosh, I love that area. Because I was a city boy and I'd go down and get to hang out in Pensacola, my grandparents. Dad worked at the Air Force Base, or grandfather worked at the great Air Force Base, and my grandma left school when she was in fifth grade to pick cotton. Again, things people don't know. I want to hear. We'll have to compare.
Yeah, I got family in Columbus, Georgia, and they're all Auburn fans.
They should be. War Eagle. All right. I have a limited partnership. My seat and Bill, by the way, Bill Widener here is big time.
Oh, yeah.
And then Drew's all Roll Tide. I'm like, All right. I have a limited partnership. My C corporation is 1%. The partners have different shares. They all want us to do 1031 exchange into their own purchases. Is this allowed? So the answer is really no. What you'd have to do is you go limited partnership to limited partnership. Like it has to stay name to name. And then what you do is you would dissolve it after that and you would you'd issue out the individual properties. And you basically liquidate it and issue out the individual properties to the individuals. I believe you could do that.
Okay, just spitballing here. Could they distribute the property beforehand to the partners as tenants in common, assuming they're all individuals?
That's called a drop and swap. And you could potentially do that, but it would have to be done way in advance of the exchange. So they all want to do a 1031 exchange.
But they want to purchase their own property.
The question is when they're already sold. So assuming that it's sold or imminent, then we'd have a little bit of an issue. Hey, somebody said dogs. Oh, they must be a Georgia fan. We like Georgia, too. Like Georgia, too. Now, I had family that lived in a place called Tallahassee, Alabama, on Lake Martin. We'd go down there and fish with a cousin Moose. That's not a joke either. I never tell anybody this stuff. I just tell the world. All right. What happens to the idle loan if the owner of the business passes away? They're not on the hook. So the business is secure. Like that loan would actually be securitized by the assets of the business. That's all they'd get. Somebody says West Virginia. See, now we got them all started. We got people all over the place. All the Southerners are popping out. We love you guys. All right. If somebody says the idle loan, it's not recourse to you and it's secured by the business asset. So the business would be responsible. So if you died, it wouldn't mean anything to it. You're not even a guarantor. Somebody says, so can I take an early withdrawal from my 401k for the CARES Act, even though I'm retired, as an early withdrawal, or would it be taxes? I'm 59 years old. So you could borrow money and it would not be taxable at all. Or you could take, if you've been affected by COVID, you could take up to $100,000 out and pay it back over the next 3 years. I hope that makes sense. Ohio born, Alabama raised. I like that. All right. If I start using my my business office for W-2 work, do I lose the home office deduction? And the answer is
yes.
For a sole proprietor, right?
Well, he said for his W-2 business.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm assuming he's an employee.
If you're an employee for your W-2 work, then we'd have to have, I think you could actually have two workplaces. What you wouldn't be able to do is get reimbursed by one employer and use it for your own C-Corp. But I believe that if you did it as a administrative office, but if it's a, you'd be okay. If it's a sole proprietorship, then it has to be exclusively used for that one business.
Yeah. I mean, your employer could reimburse you to work at home and it would be tax-free to you. But the old home office deduction for employee expenses is gone.
Mm-hmm. So I guess there's two ways to look at this. The traditional home office is a separate tax form that you file and put with a Schedule C. Mm-hmm. And your employer, if it starts reimbursing you, or if you tell anybody that you're using it for that, it might not pass the exclusivity test. And you might have an issue. If this is a reimbursement where you have an administrative office in the home, you can have multiple administrative offices in the home, but you can't get reimbursed for the same space twice.
Right.
You'd have to say this half is this and this half is this. Somebody asked a good question, so I'm just going to repeat it to you guys. For those owners who have not yet filed income taxes for 2019, so this is really important. Your taxes are due on July 15th. Your tax return isn't due until October 15th if you file for an extension. So I'm telling everybody, because we don't know what they're going to come out with in this next tax act, in the next bill.
They could do another extension, which I would not be happy about, but they could do it.
They could do an extension, but bigger yet, I'm waiting for them to give you some relief off the taxes you paid in 2019. Like, I still think the easiest way to give people money is to give them back some of what they just paid, because we know what it was. We know how much it was. And if you didn't pay it, then just keep it. So I don't know why the government didn't do that. We're paying out stimulus checks to, by definition, 85% of the people don't need it. And they're giving it to a bunch of dead people, and they're giving it to people that don't even live here. They're a bunch of idiots. So I don't know why they did that. Just give it back to the people that paid it. And anyway, that's me whining. And then the unemployment was, you know, they could bolster up if people are really affected, but the unemployment, what they did was just, they made a mess. All right, so if you haven't filed your taxes for 2019 and thus far only have estimated gross revenue, is there any concern whether the gross revenue stated on the EITL app will be cross-referenced? Can they be substantially different? No. So when you're submitting that application is the day in which you're testifying as to how much you incurred. And so a lot of times they know people are, it used to not be uncommon for somebody to go back in and get more money, depending on how badly they were affected. And now it's pretty brutal because we're still working through April. Like literally we're getting through the end of April, maybe, you know, like April was the cutoff. So we were still working on those. So we're applying for new ones. Maybe somebody on my staff could tell me whether we have any that we've actually obtained for people that filed in, that actually received their money, not just the approval, not just filling out the paperwork, but have actually gotten funded from the second tranche, because that didn't open up until about 2 weeks ago. So anyway, I wouldn't be worried about it. Let's go to this next one. And I know there's a lot of questions out there, guys. Our guys are going on it. Somebody said, go Gators. Oh, that's Pyle.
Is he from Florida?
He's naughty. We're going to have a little chat with him. Gator fan. He's got bad taste. No, I'm just kidding.
My significant other is Florida State grad, so.
Tallahassee.
She's not going to like the Gator thing.
Ah. Well, you just put yourself on the outs. All right. I am a new home builder with 15 homes built a year. Do I expense home by home after it's sold, or can I do fiscal year expense and income accounting together? Do you want to hit this one, or would you like I?
Home builders have some special rules. They can usually use the cash method. The preferred method is the completed contract method, where you're not deducting expenses or recognizing income on a home that you built until it's complete, 95% complete, and the customer has started using it.
If that was in a corporation, though, wouldn't you just treat that like inventory?
Yeah, you are a work in progress. Same thing.
Yeah, so you're not. It's not that you have to do a tax. You're paying the tax. I think what they're asking is, can I just do it all together?
Well, there was a case back in 2017. I can't recall, Shea Homes. Where they argued that they were building the development that had streets, a lot of common area structures and all. And their argument was, well, yeah, the home's been sold, but the common areas aren't filled out, so we haven't hit the 95%. And they actually succeeded in winning that entire development, until the entire development was 95% complete.
That you wouldn't actually have
to recognize. They didn't have to recognize anything.
So for these guys, assuming they're not a developer and they're putting in all the streets, what they would say is, I recognize on an annual basis only the homes that I've sold.
Correct.
And I'm not doing it every time I sell a home. I'm doing it on an annual period based on the homes that I sold during that 12 months.
Correct. So you would recognize the income on any homes that are considered complete each year.
Yep.
And completed contract only works for long-term contracts of at least 12 months.
Yeah.
From start to finish. If you have shorter contracts, you're going in and renovating kitchens, bathrooms, stuff like that, that's going to be a much shorter period. And those income expenses are recognized as they come up.
Oh, somebody says for amounts 25,000 and above, this is for somebody asking for amounts $25,000 plus, what if the business has none of the assets as stated in the loan agreement? Then again, this is for the EITL loan. And I believe what they're saying is, hey, I get a $100,000 EITL loan and I go meet my maker in year two. What's this SBA going to do? So I've negotiated a few of these during the 2008 fiasco. I actually did a very large one. about a $4 million issue with a widower, the widow of somebody who passed. And I'll just tell you, the SBA was easy peasy to deal with. What ends up happening is they look at what are the assets there. In this particular case, they even had a personal guarantee that they let her out of, and she had other assets. We just made a really compelling argument that we needed their assistance to allow her to unwind herself out of a very large restaurant here. And so if let's say you have $100,000, it's the company's loan, Mark, and it's supposed to be being used to help it recover from this nasty period. It's just giving you a long term to pay it back. The SBA knows that a lot of these are going to default, and that's why it's not a regular bank that's giving it to you. Mm-hmm. Regular banks don't do disaster loans.
So let's say that I've gotten an EIDL loan, but I don't have any entities, no LLCs. I just have rental properties in my Schedule C.
Yeah.
Is there any recourse there?
They'd be able to go after the assets. Yeah.
But still, they would only be able to go after assets, not even personal assets.
Well, that's an interesting one, since typically in an EIDL, it's going after the business and the business equipment. So here, I've not seen them do a deed of trust. It's all UCCs, so it's all the equipment. So they're just going to look at the business and say, okay. So they could go get your computers and things like that. That's about it. What do we have next? I think this is the last one. So you guys are lucky. We're only 45 minutes over this time. I need to make a real estate business in California. I formed a Wyoming LLC. Do I need to file another California LLC, or is it okay to register Wyoming LLC in California? What is the difference? So first thing, LLCs are creatures of state law. You can form them anywhere. When they're doing business in a state, that's like you moving into a state. So the LLC is moving there saying, hey, California, I'm going to be here for a while, in which case you register. So whatever it does in California, it applies California law. So if you do something with a California citizen or anything like that, they're going to apply all the California law. Now, on the internal workings of the LLC, you go to the home state, Wyoming. So this could become pretty critical depending on what type of business you're doing. So if you're doing a real estate business, Wyoming has a lot of protection, from creditors. So it protects the business from you. So if you do something individually and you may live someplace else, you know, depending on where you live, I don't know, it could be Wyoming, California, heck, it could be Texas. And they get a judgment against you, they'd have to go to Wyoming to try to take that away. And Wyoming is 10 times better than California from that standpoint. So I like Wyoming. It's also, there is privacy there. In California, you would lose some of that privacy. What you can do is either register the LLC directly into California, or if you're a privacy buff, you set up a California LLC and make it member managed, with the member being Wyoming. And if you know how that works, your name's not going to be part of it. So it ends up working really, really well. All right. There's a couple questions that are popping around out there. Somebody says, I'm a physician with W-2. My wife is real estate professional status. Can we deduct cost segregation depreciation from our cash flowing rentals from my W-2, given that it's passive income? So the answer is yes. As long as your wife qualifies as a real estate professional, it's an exclusion to the passive income test. It's 26 USC 469 C7 that allows you to do that. And this is very common. So if you don't know what cost segregation is, it's a fancy way of saying breaking out the components in a property to allow you to rapidly depreciate them. And in our purposes, we can write them all off in 1 year. So it gives you about a 30% deduction of the value of the improvement real estate. So if you buy a house for $1 million and $200,000 is land and $800,000 is the improvement, you'd get about a $240,000 deduction year one. It's about typical. And it would offset your W-2. So, yay. Also, can I open a Wyoming holding without having other ties in the state? If I live in one state and have property in Texas, yes. Yay. That's why we use them. The only tie you'd have is you as an individual owner. And it's a lot of fun. So those are good questions. There's a bunch of other questions. Somebody's telling me to keep whining. Hey, did EIDL reopen? It was only open. So yes, it did reopen for all businesses about, I want to say 2 weeks ago. It might be a week and a half ago. It might have been last week. Gosh, the weeks are blending. So somebody knows better than me. Maybe Patty or somebody knows. Somebody can answer it. We'll make sure. All right. Hey, go to our podcast if you like this stuff. We actually take the Tax Tuesdays and we break them down. Somebody just asked about the affiliations. We actually, the business tie is you use a office suite in Wyoming, so you can actually have it there. They always call it a principal place of business. It has to be more than an empty office, but it's just called a nexus. So we have a little service that meets it on an annual basis that we just aggregate amongst all the clients. It ends up being a pretty low cost alternative to actually getting an office suite. It's hundreds of dollars on an annual basis, not thousands or anything like that. All right, Anderson Advisors Podcast. Go in there. We actually put these Tax Tuesdays. So hope you're realizing that Tax Tuesday is about stuff that's going on with other people. Sometimes it's you can get your stuff answered, but half the fun is listening to everybody else's scenarios and answering them. And yeah, I do grab and I pull stuff out and I'm answering questions. What we'll do is you can always ask your questions, by the way. Here, I'll just put it. Here's a bunch of our podcasts. You can go in there, Google Play. I'm going to give you guys where you could ask questions. You could always ask questions on the Tax Tuesday at Anderson Advisors. You could send them in. If I don't get to your question here, we actually pull those ones out and answer them too. Somebody says, do you do consultations? Absolutely. It's part of our platinum service. But if you reach out to Patty or send it in, we could have somebody take a look at some of your returns and give you an idea of what's being done right, wrong, or, if you have a good accountant, by the way, we're never going to break you free of them. We're going to say, go and hug that person, maybe buy them some roses. It's hard to find good accountants. Somebody asks, I rent out a home for 20 years, then move into it. How long do I have to live in it to qualify for the full 250 Section 121 capital gains exclusion? So there's two sides to that. The answer is 2 years. You get a partial after any period of time if you're forced to leave. But it's going to be based on the fair market value when you move into it.
Right.
So it's not like I've had this house for 20 years and it's gone up in value. Now I move into it, I'm going to get this huge chunk of capital gain exclusion. It's only on the capital gains from the time that I move into it to the time that I sell it, if you're living in it as your primary place of living. Realistically, I would 1031 exchange that puppy, unless you really want to keep that property. Anyway, here's the more fun stuff. I get distracted. I still want to give you guys one last giveaway. And Sean, about this tax software, you're going to have to go back and listen. He wants me to repeat it. We actually went on for a while on that one. Do the live stream with us with the Infinity Investing on Saturday, July 18th. I love having lots of people on. Again, I'm going to have this one, Aaron Adams, Eric Dodds, Hans Johnson's coming on. If you guys don't know Hans, he's really cool. I've never had him on one of these, and it's going to be fun. Go to this link. It is free, and it is a one-day live stream. If you want to learn how to invest like people that make money consistently invest, and you don't like roller coasters, this is where you want to be. We just flat out figure out how to make money and call it getting rich slowly. But mathematically, it's almost a certainty. It's one of the few ways to do it. I'll show you guys how we cash flow things. I'm a cash flow freak. I have over 200 properties of my own that I shouldn't say just my own. It's Clint and I own a lot of them, some of my own. But we have everything from warehouses to office buildings to a lot of single families and all that fun. Hey, there's a mahalo and aloha. Jen, nice to see you. Aloha. So come on and join us Saturday, July 18th. And then by all means, if you know young people, before they do bad things to themselves and incur lots of debt, send them there. I will make sure that they never do it. And they'll be able to pull a pencil out and actually do some calculations on their own. It'll surprise you. They'll get very well acquainted with the real estate and the stock market from a cash flow perspective. This is not trading and flipping houses. We are just this is all about cash flow, so a little different. But it's mathematical formulas and how to calculate it. It's profit and loss. It's balance sheets for individuals. It's being able to tell the different types of entities and all that, or asset types. And we focus really in on rents, royalties, dividends, and in our case, short-term capital gains as infinity income sources. So please join us for that. It's free. I'll go back to that little website again. Some of you guys have probably already been on. It's so much fun. And last but not least, please join us on social media and continue to fill your brain. Ask us lots of questions. This is good for us, good for you, good for everybody. So we like doing them. Jeff and I are always like, Jeff, you've been doing this for 30 years plus, and I'm catching up. And
I hope you don't catch up.
I hope I don't either. I hope you always stay ahead of me. But every single time we do this, you should see us scratching our head sometimes. Yeah. We're like, what is that? Because trust me, this helps us stay on our toes. And then thanks to Susan, Patty, Elliot, Pio, and Tavia for answering questions. I'm sure that you guys will have more follow-up from them. We will make sure that we're trying to demystify that tax world. And boy, we almost finished on time, give or take an hour. So it is 4:55. Jeff talks so much. That's the problem. Blame it on Jeff. But anyway, thanks, guys. Watch the recording and share it with your friends. And keep growing this community, and it's a lot of fun. So until next time, this is Toby.
And Jeff.
And we'll see you at the next Tax Tuesday in 2 weeks.
Thank you for listening to today's podcast. Show notes for links to everything mentioned in this episode can be found on our website at andersonadvisors.com/podcast. Be sure you subscribe to our podcast. And if you are already a subscriber, please provide us a review of what you thought of this episode.